A new poll says the race is close in a perceived matchup between U.S. Senator Bill Nelson and Governor Rick Scott. We'll take a closer look. Good Thursday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live on the radio at 9. Also, never miss a show. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and through our app. Just ahead, UNF's polling lab is out with fresh, hot numbers, hot off the presses on President Trump, Florida's Senate race, and a lot more. You can get on the line now as we talk with pollster Mike Bender. He's a frequent guest on the show. Get on the line now, 549-2937. Then later, we're going to tell you about a new play on the JU campus, Riding the Wave of the Me Too Moment, plus the vintage sounds of the USO era, happening next weekend at Friday Music Hall. All of that ahead this hour. But first this morning, a new poll out this week from UNF's Public Opinion Research Lab says Florida Senator Bill Nelson leads just a bit for the upcoming Senate election this fall, with Governor Rick Scott trailing close behind. Scott, a Republican, is widely expected to challenge Nelson, a Democrat, for that Senate seat, which Nelson has held since 2000. Scott is term limited over in the governor's mansion. Now, UNF's polling also shows a majority of the state's voters disapprove of the job President Trump is doing. But there's a lot to go over in these numbers. Mike Bender runs the school's polling lab, and he joins us now. Hey, Mike.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good to have you on the show, as always. Here's our question to callers. Who will get your vote this fall in the 2018 midterm election? Senator Nelson is on the ballot. He is the highest Democratic office holder in this state, and he is expected to face a strong challenge from Governor Rick Scott. Give us a call. Let us know what you think about the midterm elections, as the polling does seem to favor Democrats, at least right now. Let us know your thoughts on the numbers for President Trump. Most Florida registered voters, a majority, disapprove of the president's performance. We'll go over the specifics here in just a moment, but give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And as always, we love your comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Okay, Mike, let's begin with the race for the Senate. Senator Nelson, the lone statewide office holder in Florida who's a Democrat, leading Governor Scott, but not by much. What do the numbers show?
Now, we had him up 6 points, 48 to 42, with some indecision still. But this race is yet to even get underway. Rick Scott hasn't even declared at this point.
Yeah.
I imagine mid-March, after the session wraps up, we'll be hearing a lot more from him and some others who have their eyes on higher office.
Okay, so Nelson is a guy who first got in 2000, moderate Democrat, sort of an old-style Southern Democrat, one of the only ones left, really, in the country. And he has held that Senate seat through many ups and downs, and here he is heading into re-election, facing what is sure to be a stiff challenge from a well-funded Republican opponent. Your polling shows him reasonably well positioned, but as you say, a lot can happen between now and November.
You're right in a lot of ways. This is a throwback moderate Democrat. And in so many ways, it's fascinating because he doesn't have the name recognition that Rubio has, that even Rick Scott has, and many other elected officials. Yet he's been in office the longest. He's been three-term sitting senator. People aren't fully aware of who he is. A lot of don't knows when it comes to job approval on Nelson, but he keeps winning elections. Now, you're right. This is absolutely going to be his stiffest test yet. A popular, well-funded sitting governor, and it's going to be neck and neck to the end.
How will Nelson win again? What he's done in the past may not work this time. He'll have to change strategies because, of course, Rick Scott has unlimited funds at his disposal. What Nelson has going for him, I would think, this time is, and let's get into the next set of data in your polling, lots of voters in this state are very unhappy with President Trump.
Right. And the idea that from the Republican perspective, being aligned with President Trump isn't a problem. Republicans like him.
Sure.
But for Democrats and for NPAs, the nonpartisan affiliates, and some of the other minor parties, those folks have very negative views on Trump. And Rick Scott has been supportive of Trump, has been tied to him, has made appearances with him, has gone up to Washington and met with him. So it's very easy. And I would imagine that Nelson is going to tie Scott to Trump and work on those negatives that people have about Donald Trump in Florida.
UNF's Public Opinion Research Lab finds 53% of Florida voters somewhat or strongly disapprove of the president's performance in office. 43% of voters in this state approve. Now, as you say, of course, among Republicans, the president has sky-high approval rating. Among registered Democrats, he has sky-high disapproval rating. Florida is split right down the middle, as it always is.
And much like the rest of the country, there are big partisan divisions on how you view the president in this administration. And you're going to see that come full force come the fall.
Yeah. And so as we go beyond the Bill Nelson-Rick Scott matchup, which is widely expected, although it's not a guarantee. I mean, everyone thinks Scott's going to get in, but he might not.
I'll make the analogy to sports. Josh McDaniels, the offensive coordinator for the New England Patriots, just backed out of the head coaching job with the Indianapolis Colts. Everybody thought that was a done deal. So until you sign your name on a dotted line and come out publicly, I guess now on Twitter, and say you're running.
Fat ladies aria has not, we haven't heard the opening notes yet.
Right.
Could Scott look at your numbers and say, you know what? Maybe this is not the time. Maybe this is not the year. Maybe Donald Trump's headwinds are not going in my direction.
If you're Rick Scott, there is no better time. Are you going to wait? What are you going to wait and challenge Rubio in a primary? Are you going to wait 6 years and do it then for an open seat when you've perhaps been out of office? Are you going to go back and run for Congress? I don't. If you have your eye on higher office and staying in public life in Florida, this is your chance. And we talked about Trump's negatives. Rick Scott has some of the highest approval numbers we've ever polled. He's over 60% for job approval. So if not now, never, I think, for Rick Scott.
Now, we have heard a lot about the president's negatives creating a so-called blue wave when it comes to the Democrats' desire to take back the House of Representatives. The Senate would be in their sights, too, potentially. But according to your polling in Florida, 42% of likely voters say they're going to vote for a generic Democratic candidate for the House. 40% say they will vote for the Republican. 14% don't know. That doesn't indicate to me a blue wave necessarily.
And these numbers are lower than the rest of the country nationally. And the one thing that you have to consider when thinking about this blue wave is it's not just votes cast, it's candidates running. And if you look at Republicans across the country, you've seen a lot of retirements. You're not seeing that from Democrats. You're also seeing Democrats fielding stronger candidates. So it's a two-wave process. It's not just votes, it's the candidates that are out there. And in Florida, we have a couple of, you know, close congressional seats that could be up, particularly down south in 26 and 19. And there's some close races that Democrats have their eyes on.
Did you do any polling on specific races in our listening area? For example, the Al Lawson, Alvin Brown congressional race, or the one down in, I think it's CD6.
CD6 with Soderbergh.
Nancy Soderbergh and a Republican candidate to be chosen. And there are several in our area.
And we're gonna wait until those races develop a little bit more. We'll definitely be doing the and the Lawson-Brown race that you alluded to is going to be determined in the primary. Those are both Democrats. It's a heavily Democratic seat. So that race is going to be in August. We're going to wait for that to develop a little. And then if we do anything in CD6, that's a tough road to hoe. That's a pretty Republican district. But we will definitely probably do some polling in there more later in the summer when we get more into the heat of the campaign.
One more data set Mike Binder found over at UNF's polling lab. Florida voters were asked about whether they approved the way Special Counsel Robert Mueller is handling his job investigating Russian involvement in the 2016 election. 40% of Florida registered voters somewhat or strongly approve. 28% somewhat or strongly disapprove. 29% don't know.
Right. And I was a little, we had never polled on this before. We hadn't had a history of special counsel lately. So I wasn't here when Ken Starr was investigating Clinton. But these numbers are a little bit different than they were earlier nationally from when Mueller first started the investigation. They're down, and you're seeing a much greater partisan split as well.
Let's go to your calls now as we speak with Mike Binder of UNF's Public Opinion Research Lab. Who gets your vote this November in the 2018 midterm elections? 549-2937. Give us a call as we're talking politics and polling on the show this morning. Gil is in San Marco. Hey, Gil. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Hi, Melissa. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Well, listen, I just wanted to say, in terms of the choice between Bill Nelson and Rick Scott, I think Rick Scott does not get my vote. And the reason for saying that is, you know, Rick Scott used to be the CEO of the hospital corporation that was accused of Medicare fraud and was fined over $1 billion, the highest fine ever, before he got into office. And then once he got into office, of course, we did have that commuter rail, and he stiff-armed that, which would have been really helpful for not only creating jobs in Florida, but also giving people options in terms of traveling in Florida. You know, he's also been a big supporter of Donald Trump. And I've had the misfortune of actually working on Trump Tower back in the 70s. And I knew that Trump was involved with the mob. He was doing all kinds of crazy things. He's a bigot. Beyond that, he's offered all of these policy observations, but without any precision at all. You've never gotten any precision about policies from Donald Trump. I always say to people when they ask me about Donald Trump, Donald J. Trump, the J in Trump stands for Adolf. It really does.
Hey now.
Yeah, it really stands for Adolf. He's trying to follow the playbook of, you know, of the fascist back then. It sounds a little harsh until you look at his policies and his programs and his
all
people.
Right. All right, Gil, I appreciate the call. This is the second day in a row that somebody has made that comparison. And I just got to say, I understand the emotions are running incredibly strongly now. But I would like to just point out that, for my mind anyway, Godwin's law is valid. And that's the whole idea that, in general, I don't think it's a good idea to compare people to Hitler. That's what Godwin's law basically states.
Especially not somebody that moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem.
Yeah, so, I mean, but that said, right. Gil, and the guy that called yesterday, I understand the anger about policies that many Americans interpret as fascist. And so I understand that, and I certainly want to provide the platform for people to give voice to it. So I appreciate the call.
And I think if you're looking to make that comparison, I don't know that I would make it myself, but a Mussolini might be a better option.
I've heard that comparison made
right.
as well.
Not accurate, but I think the Hitler comparison is probably not at all.
But what about his overall comments?
I think there's two things that you know, if you don't like the policies that Rick Scott has put forth in the state of Florida in the last 7-8 years, then certainly you might want to look to Nelson as a vote. And then the other thing that he alluded to was the scandal that Scott had before coming into office. And he's won 2 elections statewide, having that publicly out there. And the one thing I will say about the Scott administration that nobody can deny is there hasn't been scandal. If you look at the folks in Tallahassee and the things that have been coming out in the last year, think about a Jack LaValla and a lot of the sexual improprieties and harassment. Mm-hmm. None of that has happened in the Scott administration. So I don't know that scandal is going to be his problem.
There have been other things, but nothing with his immediate staff.
Right.
There have been other issues, though. For example, this whole thing about allegedly his people have been told not to use the phrase climate change. I'd call that a scandal.
I don't know if I'd call that a scandal.
I'd call that controversial.
Controversial, maybe, but it's not like they had access to data like the tobacco companies did and buried it specifically or something of that nature. You know, not using terms is not, I don't know if I would consider that illegal or anything of that nature.
Okay, let's go to some more calls for UNF's Mike Binder at 549-2937. Rosemary in Ponte Vedra. Hi, Rosemary. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling regarding, I would definitely support Senator Bill Nelson over Rick Scott. And my main complaint with the Scott administration is, too, that there was a sales tax levied that was specifically for Florida Forever funds to buy additional properties that would, maintain the unique Florida ecology that we have. And all of those funds were just put into the general fund. They were not earmarked as they were intended, as we voters voted for it. And so I would never give him additional responsibility now to support me in the Senate after he was kind of duplicitous in the way he treated that money in the state of Florida.
Mm. Okay, thanks for that. That's Rosemary out in Ponte Vedra this morning, Mike.
Right, and then that's, again, falling on the policies that Rick Scott has done and implemented. And his environmental record has not been great. And you alluded to that just a minute ago with the use of climate change and awareness and paying attention to an issue that I think is important for Florida, particularly considering our sea level shortcomings. You get a couple feet of sea level change and Florida is in some real trouble as far as where our houses are and where we live.
Absolutely. And here's a comment. Here's a somewhat related issue Michael puts on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Both sides in the Senate race will be playing the oil drilling issue to bring Trump to their side. Let's talk about that. Hey. The whole issue of how Trump exempted Florida from his desire to open up the entire eastern seaboard to offshore oil drilling.
And this is actually a good segue where we've got some additional polling that we're going to be coming out with on Monday. And we include polling on offshore oil drilling and what registered voters in Florida think about having it here or not having it here in Florida. And the one thing with these types of policies, a lot of people might think it's a good idea somewhere else. And a state like Florida that's so dependent on tourism and the beaches, both in the Gulf and on the East Coast, I'm not sure that for Florida's money, it's necessarily the best thing. And if you look up and down Eastern Seaboard, North Carolina, South Carolina, New Jersey, the role that summertime tourism plays in that area and the beaches, the money, I don't think you make up for just by throwing a few oil platforms off the coast.
We'll go back to your calls in a moment as we continue talking with Mike Binder of UNF's Public Opinion Research Lab. New polling out this week about where Florida stands some 10 months out, 9 months out from the 2018 midterm elections. Now, unlike most off-year elections, this one looks to be a little more intense than usual. We need to know where you stand. Do you approve or disapprove of the job the president is doing? They have polling on that. Who will get your vote in the U.S. Senate race? Will it be Governor Rick Scott, who's expected to challenge Senator Bill Nelson? Who gets your vote there? And here are a few more comments for you, Mike, coming in on social media. On our First Coast Connect Facebook page, Paula writes, I'm voting for Nelson. I'd write in one of my cats before I'd ever vote for a Republican again. I'm not happy with Trump, and I'm not happy with Scott either. But here's an email from a listener, Ed. Just like Dr. Bones on Star Trek, Trump is rude, no filter. He's socially unsophisticated, but he gets things done. It's the economy, stupid, just like Clinton said. Okay, so say we get to November. The economy is still doing well. Let's assume that.
Which is a big assumption.
But let's just say we're still doing all right. Donald Trump, how's he doing in Florida? And how does that affect all of these down ballot races? It's hard to predict, but...
Sure, it's hard to predict. And the one thing I think is worth noting, the economy is good right now, and Donald Trump's approval numbers are low and have been low.
That's a good point.
So to think that they're going to improve if the economy gets better, I think is a stretch. if the economy goes south, I think he might have some real problems. And I think he might be looking at Bush in a second term type of approval numbers at that point. But we're not there yet. The economy's doing fine. As far as the down ballot races, the one thing I found really interesting, we mentioned earlier the generic vote for Congress and if you vote for Democrat or Republican. If you look at the split between how Democrats would vote and how Republicans would vote, it was literally identical. 82% of which within each party would vote for their party, 6% for the out party. So it's going to come down to turnout. There's a few more Democrats in this state, but historically in the midterms, the Republicans tend to do better as far as getting their folks out to vote.
And let me ask you about that. In the midterms, yes, typically Republicans do a much better job of turning out. Do you think that will hold true this November?
Well, I think there's a couple things that help Republicans, and one is the demographics. Who is in the Republican Party, they tend to be your super voters. They tend to be older. They tend to be whiter. They tend to be more invested and interested in the political scene. Democrats in Florida particularly tend to be younger, tend to be further south, and there's a lot in urban cores that make turning out difficult. There's interest levels. So I think the Democrats are hindered in that regard. But if they can get excited, and it's not just Democrats getting excited, it's Republicans getting turned off so that they stay home. And you saw that in Alabama with Roy Moore. It wasn't that Democrats turned out, but they did. It was the fact that Republicans didn't show up. And if Republicans don't show up, I think the Democrats could have a very big year.
Carrie in San Marco. Hello, Carrie. What are your thoughts?
I just have a question. How do dividends affect how people vote? And I say that because oil and gas has controlled the geopolitical scene in the country and maybe even on the globe, with Russia so interested in gas and with Florida needing solar power that could have rescued its whole economy. Florida would be another place if they had gone solar much long ago. So I just want to know, these old people that collect their dividend checks from you know, the sources that are all funded by oil and gas, can you tell me how much that influences an election? Thank you.
Sure. Well, that's certainly one of the big interests that plays a part.
Sure. Yeah. Personal interest always matters when it comes to who you're going to vote for. And I think Trump is banking on that literally with his tax cut, making the case that there's more money in your taxes and more money that's in your paycheck. So if you're somebody who's reliant on these type of revenues to survive, I think it certainly could impact your vote choice. I'm not sure that you're going to find too many Democrats necessarily that are willing to vote for a Republican just to get an extra couple bucks.
And as she commented as well, those big money interests are certainly doing what they can to influence the vote. And those traditional fossil fuel interests have hindered the growth of alternatives and renewables in Florida, particularly solar, which you would think would be farther along in the Sunshine State.
Sure, absolutely. And policy implementation and the role that large companies with a lot of money have is absolutely matters. When it comes to votes, I think it matters less more and more every day. We have more and more access to information via social media, via a litany of different cable news networks that you cannot control them. So I think the idea that, oh, oil and gas has put, you know, $100 million into these political races and therefore everybody's going to, all the Republicans are going to win, I don't think that's quite the case anymore.
You don't think it's as relevant?
I don't think it's as relevant at all. I think money matters, but I think there's enough money on both sides. I don't think it plays the detrimental effect as many other people might think.
Okay. Tom on the West Side. Go ahead, Tom. What are your thoughts? Good morning.
Yes. I just wanted to comment on something that was said earlier when it was said that Scott had been scandal free, and remind you know, all about the Jennifer Carroll incident where she was forced to resign as lieutenant governor. A couple other resignations, I believe, at that time, too. So not quite scandal-free.
Okay, thank you for that.
Right, but that's true. I won't disagree with that at all. But again, that was something that literally was entirely out of Scott. I mean, it was his, you know, person high in the cabinet, but not
lieutenant governor.
Lieutenant governor, yeah, but not. And even she was a little bit tangentially connected to that. He was, you know, not involved in that at all. He wasn't Jack LaValla.
549-2937. Carolyn is in Middleburg. Hey, Carolyn.
Hi. I just wanted to comment also on scandal for Rick Scott. When he owned the Semantic stores, and you touched on it a little bit, people testified that worked for him that he didn't want people of color being hired, and he didn't want people that had any weight issues. Being overweight was another thing. There was a list of things, and they kind of all narrowed down to white people are good to hire if they're in shape, kind of. So I wanted to mention that, and I wanted to ask why somebody hasn't checked into why a state like Florida, their solar program isn't better than it is, and it's been more proactive. And I think because the oil and gas have such a big lobby, and probably have a big lobby with Rick Scott, and I wish that investigative reporters would check into where that money goes in the coffers and why a state like Florida couldn't lead the nation. I know we have a lot of rain, but, you know, I know Arizona would be better, but Florida mm-hmm. should be a great spot for solar. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Carolyn. Well, 2 points there. A lot of Rick Scott's ethical issues that dogged him during his race for governor, they were reported on, and it didn't prevent him from being elected governor.
And it was all before he got into office.
And then her point about solar, a lot of the lobbying efforts that have slowed the growth of solar have actually occurred in the legislature.
Right. And that's not the voters that are necessarily being driven by that. Now, you have a heavily Republican legislature, both in the House and the Congress. And you've had a Republican governor. The idea that you're going to see state funds allocated for renewable energy and solar power, I think that's a little naive to think that that's going to happen no matter what the circumstance is, no matter what state you're in, no matter how much that a given entity such as big oil and big and gas is going to prevent that. I think this is a lot more ideological than it is just people are on the take.
Ricky on the north side. Go ahead, Ricky.
Yeah, talking about scandals and Rick Scott. What about Pam Bondi and Trump University? And he didn't accept funds from the stimulus package to get a high-speed train, right?
Oh, yeah, you're talking about the light rail. Okay, thanks for that, Ricky. Mike, they're calling you out
on
a lot
of
stuff they're remembering. Okay,
they
so let's talk about Attorney General Pam Bondi and the issue that she got caught up with regard to the widely derided and definitely scandal-plagued Trump University.
But apparently, according to him, it's coming back. I mean, Trump University is on the road to recovery, so he says, or
you
has
say
said
with
in
sarcasm,
the past,
yeah.
A little bit.
Okay.
Right, and again, you know, it's something that Rick Scott, yes, member of his cabinet,
that's
AG.
That's a member of his cabinet.
Right,
yeah.
AG, sure.
I mean, these are all things
but these are not people that are going to be running with him for Senate.
Sure, but these are definitely things that Nelson can point to.
He can. I'm not sure how much traction he's going to get, to be perfectly honest. People that might care about that have probably already made up their minds. The people who he needs to get people to vote. And I don't know that Pam Bondi taking some money for a speaking appearance for Trump University is going to get people to show up.
Martin is in Mandarin. Calls from all over the area. Hi, Martin. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. I just wanted to add one other comment about Governor Scott. Is I believe he probably moved to Florida from wherever he had been living at the time his company got in trouble because he wanted to protect a big part of his money from a lawsuit, because the Florida homestead law, unlike a lot of states, you can't sue and take away somebody's house. So I suspect that's why he moved here. Then he used a big part of his money to buy the governorship in 2 terms. So I think that ends my comment.
Okay, thanks, Martin. Of course, we have no idea if it has anything to do with why the governor moved here. That said, that's why guys like O.J. Simpson moved here, because you can't take someone's house when someone's trying to take it.
I will point that though Rick Scott used a ton of his money in the first election, in the second election, he didn't use nearly as much, and he raised a lot of money, and that was donations from regular, everyday Floridians that kind of buoyed him
in
2014.
Yes, that's true, and he went into re-election with solid job approval numbers.
Yes, and Charlie Crist, I think, by all accounts, is not the strongest of candidates for a host of reasons. So, and it was a very close race, but The first race, yes, he put money into it. The second race, not nearly as much.
So this poll is fascinating to look at, and you've got another one coming soon.
Yeah, Monday we'll be coming out with a lot more statewide. We have a look at favorability numbers for half a dozen of the major gubernatorial candidates, and then we have some policy issues for where registered voters sit on DACA and guns on campus and offshore oil drilling and legalization of marijuana, a variety of issues coming out Monday.
Can't wait to hear it. As always, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Mike Bender runs UNF's Public Opinion Research Lab. Much more still ahead. Meanwhile, later, go back in time to the era of the USO at Friday Musicale. We'll get swinging with some of their music later in the hour. But up next, why JU's new production rides the wave of the Me Too moment. We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Doug Hansard, and I listen to the Florida Times Union On Demand as read by WJCT Radio Reading Service volunteers. The sound quality is excellent. This is a great asset for people like me, sightless and on the go. The Florida Times Union Daily on the radio reading website at wjct.org/radio reading. Take advantage of it, and while you're there, register as a listener.
Were absolutely forbidden from falling in love with Muslims. I mean, by the time I was 10, I knew that when a Christian Arab girl falls in love with a Muslim, one or all of the following would happen. She is disowned, her mother gets a heart attack, or she dies in an honor killing.
Join us for stories about the things we do in the name of love. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, this is Keith Marks. Join me every Thursday evening at 11 p.m. for Avant Radio, a show of curious music for curious minds. Each show is themed, curated, and contextualized to explore new music. Come get curious on Thursdays at 11 on 89.9 FM.
WJCT offers a 24-hour classical music service dedicated to live classical music programming 24 hours a day. To find out more, visit us at wjct.org/hd.
Welcome back. Well, it's a classic play that examines the idea that women in the Victorian era were forced into prostitution, not because they had loose morals, but because of economic necessity. George Bernard Shaw's Mrs. Warren's Profession is considered to be one of his greatest works and also one of his most controversial. At the height of the Me Too and Time's Up movements, This work is a reexamination of the socio and cultural relationships between men and women. And it's being performed at Jacksonville University beginning next Friday. Here with more, we welcome Professor Deborah Jordan. She's the head of acting and directing at JU and plays Mrs. Warren. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Nice to be here.
Also with us, Sarah Stepp, a sophomore in theater arts, and she plays Mrs. Warren's daughter, Vivi. Good morning to you.
Hi, thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for being here. Okay, so this was written in the Victorian era, pretty shocking for its day, I would guess, correct?
Mm. Absolutely. It got its first production 8 years later by taking out all the references or words that referred to the oldest profession.
And in fact, it took 9 years for this to even be produced on the stage. Why is that?
Because of the subject matter.
Just too controversial.
Yeah. Well, everybody knew it was going on, but nobody talked about it. And so Shaw took matters into his own hands and mansplained through a woman.
Really? and Vivi, were even the cast and producers of the play actually arrested at one point? Is that right?
Yes, actually. The woman who played the first Mrs. Warren was actually arrested after the show was previewed for public indecency. So yeah, that did happen.
Because they were hinting at the world's oldest profession on the stage and why women were doing this, more importantly.
Mm-hmm. It was kind of, I feel like it was one of those things where it's like everyone knows what's going on. It's one of those like out of sight, out of mind type of things.
Sure.
Yeah.
And in that era, people just in polite society didn't talk about this.
Absolutely not. And that was the point that was made. The irony of it was that its first production was done at an all-men's club in London, where women were not allowed to be in because it was a subject matter unfit for women's ears.
Sure, their delicate ears. Now, the big breakthrough that George Bernard Shaw made with this, too, of course, that so shocked society was he was making the argument that women were forced into prostitution not because they were loose women, mm-hmm. but because they had no choice.
Yes. Mrs. Warren makes the case that women were either born into money or they spent a lifetime of slavery and terrible wages. And so this was an out for other women where they could have their own business, make their own money.
Save their own money. Mm-hmm.
And so what has it been like as you read through the text of this play set over 100 years ago and look at it through today's eyes?
So, you know, we go through the rehearsal process and we run our lines and we talk about the scenes. And when we really sit down and talk about it, the discussion is always brought up, you know, what has changed? So that's something that we're noticing as we go through the rehearsal process and we're getting ready to open. We really think about, how have things really changed and how much further do women still have to go compared to 100 years ago? And now I think we're still on a road to women's, you know, empowerment and stuff.
Yeah, it's definitely the year of the woman. Mm-hmm. But I think the Me Too movement has brought out how many women were held back in the workplace because of what men were doing or the way society was. Let's put it that way.
So when you started work on this production, did you do it intentionally or was this just good timing that this whole movement is going on as you're putting this play on?
A little of both. I think we anticipated that this year would be the year of the woman. And I can't think of a better play that would embrace that idea.
Mm-hmm. Shaw really was ahead of his time, wasn't he?
Absolutely. Very controversial, too. Very wordy. But his language is just amazing. It's written so British, but he has a way of with words. And that's one thing as a professor, too, is that our students get to take such an incredible work, dramatic literature, and make sense of it and put it on stage.
Now, the two of you play mother and daughter in the show. What is that relationship like on stage? How did the two characters progress during the story?
It kind of, it goes up and down. I feel like they're very misunderstood, but at the same time, they're so alike. They just don't want to admit it maybe all the time. Kind of, you know, that's how it always is with the relationship between a real mother and daughter. You're so alike, but, you know, you don't always want to admit it. So it's kind of funny. We talk about that in our rehearsal process.
Yeah, at the heart of the play, it's about a story about a mother and daughter. And I think everybody that comes and sees the show, especially if you're mother and daughter or a female, you're going to relate to that in mm-hmm. some way.
Is Vivi forced into prostitution too, the daughter?
No, actually, my character is a Cambridge graduate, very proper, prim, high class, and
I've kept her out of the business. She really doesn't know much about what I do.
I don't know anything about it.
I see. You want something better for her?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so then you don't want. I know you don't want to give away the whole story, but.
But
tell me a little bit.
You know, the truth kind of unravels in a funny way. And the show does have some really cool comical parts, too. It's not just like a really serious, you know, kind of dowry play. It has really light, funny, comical moments, which is really cool about it. But yeah, the the truth comes out and...
It comments on itself. It comments on the subject and the hypocrisy of it, the ridiculousness of mm-hmm. it all.
And more than anything, I think what it shows is that in that era, any woman who hoped to have any agency at all for herself was forced to make these impossible, horrific choices mm-hmm. just to survive.
One of my lines in the play is the only way for a woman to provide for herself decently is to be good to a man that can afford to be good to her. That says a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is part of a series of really provocative productions that Jacksonville University has been putting on, correct?
Yeah.
I mean,
theater is about starting conversations.
Yeah.
We would be remiss if we didn't do that. And I think the arts is a place that you're going to find many voices.
You did Best Little Whorehouse in Texas last year. Now you're doing Mrs. Warren's
yes,
profession.
I was in that one too.
Going here.
Second show that we're wearing a corset in. So, you know.
What's it like to put the corset on?
Oh, man.
Does it hurt? Is it uncomfortable?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Well, we rehearse in our corsets because it, you know, it affects your posture, your breathing, how low you can get your breaths, your timing, your walking. Wearing a corset basically affects kind of the whole way your body moves. So
it helps you play the character.
Oh, for me, definitely.
Yeah,
you know, my character is always sitting up really straight, super, super proper. So the corset that'll definitely do it.
It's such a symbol of how constrained women were in that era, isn't it? Yeah, it's mm-hmm. like almost a torture device. Mm-hmm. But it really does nip in the waist, though, and creates that hourglass figure, doesn't it?
Our costume designer told us when he measured our waist without the corset and then with the corset on, it took about 5 inches off both of our waists.
Wow. Oh, you wear one too?
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
As the mother.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can never sit. You never feel the back Mm-mm. of a chair because you can't slouch.
It won't allow you.
No, Mm-mm. you make a lap. That's what it's called.
You make a lap. What's that mean?
Yeah. Instead of sitting down and sitting back, you just make a lap on the edge of your chair.
Oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
So period costumes, mm-hmm. period set design, very Victorian,
yes.
The whole thing.
Yes.
The whole thing.
Yes.
Now, when does the show debut?
We open next Friday, the 16th.
Next Friday.
Yes. We're running in rep with Aida the Musical, so they will open the Thursday before we open. Well, we're on 2 weekends, and it'll be one show one day and one show the other.
So we are the 16th, 18th, 22nd, and 24th.
Tickets on sale now. How can people get their tickets?
By calling the JU box office. You can do it online at www.jutickets.com.
Yeah.
That's it.
JUtickets.com to go see Mrs. Warren's Profession, Shaw's classic play, debuting next weekend on the beautiful JU campus. So good to talk to both of you and break a leg. I don't envy you wearing those corsets, I have to say. But everything for your art, right? Everything for your art.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Melissa, for having us on.
Thank you. Deborah Jordan heads the acting department at JU. Theater arts sophomore Sarah Stepp also with us. A quick break, and in a moment it's back to the World War II era and the USO scene. With Friday Musicale, you're going to want to stick around for that. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9, and we will be right back.
Astrology has been around in various forms for millennia, but it seems to be having a moment right now.
Me? Okay. I'm a Sagittarius, which probably tells you way more than you need to know.
It's not a science, yet it seems to make sense for millions of us. Now a new generation is setting its sights on the stars. What are they seeing, and is it really there? Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, you are being watched. We talk about state-of-the-art surveillance from closed-circuit TV to drones and satellites with Robert Draper. His article about surveillance is in National Geographic. We'll also talk about gerrymandering, which he's reported on. He says it's subverted our democracy in ways that Putin himself could never have imagined. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Bernie Madoff was a supervillain to most.
This is a man that done stole more money than anybody else.
But a superhero to some.
He's more important than Jesse James. You know what I mean? Bonnie and Clyde.
Are we safe from another Ponzi ripoff?
Cash rules everything around me. Green, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, y'all.
On the next Reveal.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Even in this digital age, the good old-fashioned business card is far from dead.
People hand out fewer of them, but they're really making some oddball cards.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, how business cards can help your business. That's next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, we want to talk for a minute about the USO era. The United Service Organizations, Inc., or USO, became the GI's home away from home during World War II, and they began a tradition of entertaining the troops that continues right up until this day. At their high point in 1944, the USO had more than 3,000 clubs around the country, and curtains were rising on U.S. shows hundreds of times a day. They featured the biggest entertainers of the era, Bing Crosby, Judy Garland, Frank Sinatra, and many, many more. Now, speaking of entertainment, we're going to take it back here to our art scene and the present-day Friday Musicale, which has been a fixture for a century now, more than a century, on Oak Street in Riverside. They have hosted artists from all over the world and trained great young musicians for decades. Friday Musicale is holding their third annual fundraiser, February 17th, and this is so cool. They are doing it as a throwback to the USO era. Executive Director Naomi Sheridan and Venue Director Jeff Tawney are here to fill us in about the Vintage USO Stars and Stripes Dinner and Dance. Good morning to you both. Thanks for coming.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having us today.
This sounds like a lot of fun. So it's going to be like one of those old-fashioned USO type events where you picture like Humphrey Bogart smoking a cigarette in the corner or something like that, right?
You know what? Absolutely. We are going to transform Friday Musicale's venues into that time era. And I'll let Jeff talk a little bit more about that, as well as the 16-piece band. And also, the live dancing will lend itself to music of that time. And I would like to have Jeff share a little bit more about what the decor will look like, because you will definitely be transformed.
Thank you so much. Yes. Our auditorium basically will be the vintage red, white, and blue room, if you will, the party room. And that's where the big band orchestra will play. And we'll have some professional singers and dancers. And then we'll be inviting everyone next door for our seated dinner, which will be in the mess hall in our next door building, which is called Lingo Hall. And again, I don't want to give any secrets away or anything, but everything's going to be really, really fun as far as the overall look and feel of the event. And we're encouraging our attendees to dress in 1940s clothing if they want to, really have fun with it and play the part. And even our staff are going to get involved in that. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
That's going to be the most fun part of all. People get to dress up in 1940s style clothes.
Yes.
How fun is that?
And then additionally, we are going to have some fun real live props out in front of our buildings, Jeeps of the era, the Jacksonville USO, which we are donating a small proceeds from our event, are also supplying us with one of their USO vans. So the entire venue will be a step back in time.
The Big Band era was the coolest. You know, it's I just love listening to the Glenn Miller Orchestra, Count Basie, and, you know, just all the music from that era was great. And to revive it even for one night and dress up, that's going to be so much fun. And for people that have never been to Friday Music Al, this is a good opportunity for people to come check you guys out because it's a beautiful place with a lot of history behind it.
Absolutely. And I just wanted to make a quick plug that Valentine's Day is soon, and this event is on the 17th, as Melissa said. And what a great date night. You get for $75 a ticket, you get dinner and dancing. And then to tie into what Melissa said about the music of the era, our band, the big band that will be playing, the Fascinating Rhythm Orchestra, is playing a song that will be choreographed to some of the student dancers that will perform with it. So that's, as Jeff mentioned, the entertainment factor. We'll have student dancers performing. And also they'll show us how to do some of those dances that I don't know how to do.
Really, like I don't know how to do the Lindy Hop.
The young ones can get on the floor and do it for us.
That was when people dressed up when they went out and they did some dances that looked just so cool. So get your tickets now at Friday Musicale. That's with an E on the end. FridayMusicale.com. For the Vintage USO Stars and Stripes Dinner and Dance, coming up Saturday, February 17th. Thanks so much, Naomi and Jeff. And by the way, we just happen to have a little big band music from your entertainment for that night coming up. Here's a little closing music from the Fascinating Rhythm Orchestra. This is who you'll be dancing to when you come on out for the big USO night. I love this. I think it's stormy weather. Yeah. Enjoy the music. 1A's up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and we'll be back tomorrow for our Friday Media Roundtable. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.